This has been a live recording of the Effing Shakespeare podcast by Bloomsday Literary at the 2023 AWP Conference and Book Fair. We're thankful to be the official podcast for AWP for a third year and have invited a gallery of guests that you don't want to miss out on. As always, please subscribe, rate, and review so we can continue to bring you interviews of amazing writers sharing about their amazing work. Enjoy.
Author of Another Appalachia, which we will discuss today. Nima Avashia was born and raised in southern West Virginia to parents who immigrated to the United States. She has been a civics and history teacher in the Boston Public Schools since 2003. Her first book, Another Appalachia, Coming Up Queer and Indian in a Mountain Place, is out now with West Virginia University Press. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Are you still at Boston Public Schools?
I am. I'm on parental leave right now because my partner and I had a little baby in November.
Oh my gosh.
So that's my main job right now.
Holy smokes. You're in it.
Yes.
Oh my word. November.
This is like the first time I've left the house since November.
Wow.
And probably first full night sleeps.
Uh-huh.
Is your partner silently dabbing daggers in your eyes?
I think probably. But she's very gracious and hasn't told me.
She's keeping it to
like
herself.
A good partner does.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Baby. Awesome. Well, we have lots in common. I did not grow up in Appalachia, but I went to grad school there. And my grandfather lives in the foothills of the Appalachian Trail. It's one of my favorite places on the planet. And I can't wait to talk about your experience.
Yeah.
And your awesome new book.
I'm psyched to talk about it. Anytime I get a chance to talk about Appalachia, I'm excited.
Can we talk about what it was like launching that book, which finalist for the 2022 New England Book Award, as well as Book Riot's 2022 Best LGBTQ+ Memoir? What was it like launching and going on some book tours there?
It was amazing. I was really nervous before launch because I have been outside of Appalachia for as long as I lived inside of Appalachia. Mm-hmm. I'm half and half at this point. And I just had a lot of trepidation about not wanting people in Appalachia to feel like this book didn't represent them. I had had the experience of reading a book about Appalachia that did not represent me, and I didn't want to replicate that.
Yeah.
And I felt like I'd been really careful about not speaking about anything other than my own experience, but that didn't mean that readers weren't going to feel a way about what they read on the page. The last 12 months, which the book came out March 2022, have been such an incredible experience of what it is like to engage with readers around your life,
mm-hmm.
Which is what happens when you write an essay collection. I didn't totally anticipate that, like, oh, yeah, I walk into rooms and people already know everything about me, right? That was unique. People would, like, Laura would come in with me and they'd be like, hi, Laura. And she'd be like, what? How do you know who I am? And it's like, well, you're in the book, too. It's been really phenomenal. I think the reception of the book in Appalachia has just been pretty emotionally, like, resonant.
Mm.
Lots of queer people coming to readings and talking about finding themselves in the book, finding a sense of comfort in the book. Lots of young people really feeling like there's a map for them where maybe there wasn't a map before. And outside of Appalachia, I also think it's made people think in a different way about their perceptions of Appalachia. You know, the cover of my book is a very famous site in southern West Virginia called Babcock Mill. Almost every West Virginia family has a picture at that mill in the fall. It's kind of classic.
Uh-huh.
But most of those pictures aren't Indian people, right? And so even if someone doesn't read my book, just looking at the cover and seeing the phrase Appalachia and the word queer and Indian people on the cover kind of disrupts their perception.
Right.
And so that's been a lot of what I feel like happens when I read outside of Appalachia, is it's about disrupting perception. It's about pushing people to consider a region of the country that often really gets stereotyped with more nuance than they've given it in the past.
Right, right. Which I wanted to ask you about that, because I think of late what we think about maybe is, especially if we're talking about memoir in Appalachia, we're going to talk about J.D. Vance. A Hillbilly Elegy came out, what year was that?
2016.
You know. Of course you know. Yes. And Jess and I watched that book launch because we had been in grad school in Tennessee. We have ties to Appalachia. my co-founder at Bloomsday, Jessica Cole, wishes she were here doing this interview because she also lives in Boston now. But we watched that book come out and catch fire and sort of gain a lot of traction. And what's interesting to me is that your book seems to be an argument for nuance itself, which I think we're so lacking in the sort of increasingly polarized political debate world that we're in now.
Yes.
How are you injecting that nuance? Like, what is that your work, do you feel like, with the memoir?
That's 100% my work. I mean, that's why the title is Another.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The word Another inherently implies there's more than one.
Right.
And I'm not saying mine is the one either, but rather that actually there are so many Anothers that you need to consider when you think about Appalachia. That's the opposite of what that book, whose name I refuse to say, does,
yes,
right? Which is, it purports to be like a definitive text about a place. And yet, there are no queer people in that book. There are no immigrants in that book. There are no black people in that book. There are no radicals in that book. And that book is profoundly disrespectful to the people who it's talking about, in that it sort of blames their conditions on them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't implicate government. It doesn't implicate industry. It doesn't look at what are all the factors. Doesn't talk about the pharmaceutical companies and the role they played in destroying my home. Like, it's just, you are poor people, you are deficient, and your problems are your fault, right? And that, I think, is actually the narrative that most of America has bought wholesale about Appalachia.
Yeah, yeah.
And not in small part due to the fact that that book was on the New York Times bestseller list for 54 weeks.
For so long.
Yeah. Mm. It is the only book about Appalachia that has gotten that kind of coverage and that kind of platform, right? So it's not people's fault, necessarily, that they have that perception.
Because it's so widespread, it's access to it.
Right?
Yeah,
and then it became a Netflix movie, and then it is a ubiquitous sort of stereotype. So, you know, I'm not deluded to think that, like, my little book is going to compete with that book. Mainstream publishing was not interested in my book. Okay, that's fine. But that doesn't prevent me from telling my story and from hoping that, like, any person who reads my story has to think a little bit differently when they're done. A lot of the work I did in my essays was to sort of try to ask the question, why? Why are people making the choices that they're making? What is the root of where we find ourselves right now? I mean, that's the question I think about in my personal life all the time. How have we gotten here? Right?
Right, right, yeah.
We didn't, like, this level of polarization, like, it didn't just happen. We got here. And what is the combination of factors that got us here? And I think in the case of, like, a lot of the people who I grew up with, who I love deeply and have lots of care for, there's a lot of grief that people are grappling with. They've watched their region be decimated by a combination of globalization taking jobs out, by the destruction of unions, by big pharma pouring pills into communities. Like, you can't see all of that and not feel a lot of grief.
The defunding of public schools.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
right?
Right.
You're gonna feel deep grief, and then who is offering you a narrative to explain your grief? Only a set of politicians who are really interested in polarization. They want you to feel angry. They don't want you to process your grief.
Exactly.
They don't want you to understand what's happening. They just want you to be mad and blame somebody. Mm-hmm. It's a very human response, right? When you're grieving, to be angry if no one helps you do anything else besides be angry.
Right. So, yeah. And then what's on the other side of that? What exists for those people on the other side?
That's right.
Yeah.
So I feel like that is sort of the area that I was trying to push into, is like, can you see people's grief? Can I help you understand?
Mm.
I think the combination of, like, COVID and literally, like, the distancing of people, and then social media, which is such a flat place, has gotten us to a really ugly place in this country where people, like, don't have nuance. They don't see each other with any depth. And I think in my book I was trying to, like, re-inject that depth into how people thought about folks in Appalachia.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me most reading your essays, particularly at the endings of your essays, they're so pointed. I always, at each chapter break, I took a pause and reflected on what you yourself, as the narrative eye in remove from the story that you're telling, what you were doing, interrogating your own experience. And at the end of the book, it made me, I think the communication in your writing style made me then say, this writer is doing that, and as a reader, I'm to do that too. And I think it's the thing that I see, it's the thing I love most about Didion or Mary Carr, and I really felt that in your pages as well. It was a very satisfying read. I'm so glad that this book is in the world.
Thank you. I think that's exactly right. Oh. Right. I like to say I didn't write a book of answers. I wrote a book of questions. It's sometimes why when people say my book's a memoir, I'm like, I don't think it is, because I think people have an expectation in memoir of an answer.
Right.
I don't have any answers. It took me 43 years to find the questions. I'm gonna die without the answers to these questions, right? But I think that if I make my grappling with the questions transparent, it invites readers to do the same. And that's actually what I've received back from readers as feedback, is like, I have the same question you have. And I felt really alone with this question.
Oh, man.
And then I realized, like, you also have this question. And that's what I think people want, right?
Yeah, like, what a gift.
You don't want to be alone with your questions. And I think so often we are. Again, the combination of, like, physical isolation, of a social media culture where you curate your identity to such an extent that it seems like you don't have any questions. People are lonely. Yeah. And people have hard questions that they're grappling with, and they don't have a place to go with them.
Yeah.
And I think that books can be that place if writers are willing to make themselves vulnerable in that way and say, I don't have the answer either, but I'll tell you my question, and I'll show you the set of experiences that are informing how I think about the question, and maybe by doing that, like, I reveal something new to you about the question and new to myself. And together, then, we kind of keep working on the question together.
Right. Rather than the book that shall not be named, where it's pointing, this is how you feel.
That's right.
I'm pointing, this is how you are.
These are the answers.
These are the answers.
And there's no space for the reader to come to that text with anything.
That's right.
There's no room.
That's right. I have the answer. The answer is blank.
And I'm like, no.
There's no answer. We are living in deeply complicated times.
Yeah,
to pretend like there are easy answers to these questions is a delusion. I mean, it's very tempting, right? People want easy answers. So again, blame immigrants for all of our problems. Blame queer people for all of our problems. We have a lot of problems. It's easy to latch on to that as the answer. It's not actually the answer, and you're going to fundamentally blame those people, do terrible violence to them, and at the end of it, still have your problem.
Yeah.
But
right.
But it is, I think, a tool that's being used right now in really violent ways.
Yeah, I agree. You said something a little bit earlier about the book not finding traction with mainstream publishers. Can you tell me a little bit about West Virginia University Press and how Another Appalachia found its way there? I keep saying that as though the book, like, walked up to the press and knocked on the door. I'm sure that you were very involved in that process, so I'd love to hear about it.
It does actually feel like the book walked up to the press. I feel like after you publish a book, it's like, oh, you're your own being.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a preview of having a child, I think, where it's like, I birthed you, and now you just do what you do, and I watch, and I'm like, oh, okay. Is that what you're doing now? Cool. All right. I'm observing.
What do you need from me?
That's right. I'm just observing. So, you know, I don't have an MFA. I didn't follow a very traditional path to publishing. I'm a full-time teacher. I wrote this book in, like, fits and spurts over the course of 4 years, between 2016 and 2020. And then I was like, well, I have a book now. What do I do? And people told me the sort of, like, traditional route, which is, okay, you write your proposal, you write your query letter, you query agents, you see who wants your book and request a full manuscript.
You say the word proposal, and a large part of my heart dies, because the proposal is such a daunting task.
It's so much work, and it's so hard. I was really lucky. I have a friend, Edie Bartles. She recently published a book called Good Grief that's about grieving your pets.
Yeah, I've heard of the book. Yeah.
She's incredible, and so she really was like, here's my proposal. Just use it as a template.
Oh, my God. Shout out to friends like that.
Yeah. I had no idea, like, what goes into this. And she had also received it from someone else, right? It was, like, this insider knowledge I didn't have, right? And she really opened the door, and I can't say enough about how important I think that is. If you have the knowledge, share the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, I did all those things, and it didn't work. you know, agents were, like, super nice. They were very complimentary. They were like, this is a beautiful book, and I don't know how to sell it. Because your book is about queer Indian Appalachian people, of whom there are, like, seven. And, like, what is the mainstream audience for this book? You know, I think for me, I just took that as feedback that, like, okay, that's not the space for this book. So then, like, what is the space? And I have some mentors, Geeta Kothari, who's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, James McCafferty, who teaches at Carnegie Mellon, and they were like, well, why don't you think about presses with a mission? And presses that have geographic roots in an area that's similar to the one that you're writing about. And think about, like, can people who share the values that you share sell your book? And that was the best feedback anybody could have given me.
That's awesome.
You know, so then, like, thinking about places like Hub City, which is right down the way, Belt Publishing, WVU, these are nonprofit presses. They have a deep mission to tell stories of the region. That's what they want to do. And that they know how to sell it because that is what they're doing all the time, right?
Right.
So then, right. like, when I submitted to WVU, they were like, oh, we want this and we totally know how to sell it.
Nice.
And that has proven to be exactly right. I can't think of a press that could have done a better job.
Oh, that's great.
Because my questions are their questions, too.
Yeah.
Right? This is not like, oh, this is a book and we need to sell it because our job is to sell books. This is people who are like, no, this story is our story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is the thing I would, if I could, like, tell writers something, I think that's actually the thing I would say is, like, everybody deserves a press that wants to fight for their story. And that's actually, like, the most important thing is to find people who like, want to fight for your story. I don't think that people always get that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they always know that that's actually the thing you should be looking for. Not necessarily, like, what is the name of the press or what is the size, but, like, what's the belief in your story?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
really good.
Yeah, I think my book, like, it's a little book. It's had a really nice long tail, and it's done some really cool things. Got coverage on CNN. Like, funky things have happened with this book. I think they've happened because the press really believed in it.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I love hearing those stories. I think we need to say it again louder for the folks louder in the back. Because there is a certain, when you talk to young authors, or not young authors, but maybe debut authors who have a manuscript and they're trying to place it, there's a certain level of desperation, especially if they've been out on submission and things aren't going well. And you just want to say, like, hang tight and really make sure that where you put this manuscript, the values align.
Yes.
Yeah.
Placement is everything.
Yeah.
I think placement is everything when you're publishing, like, essays or stories also, right? I always think it's interesting when people are like, I made a goal of submitting 100 times a year. And I'm like, awesome and exhausting. And also, like, maybe submit 15 times, but be really strategic.
Mm-hmm.
Think about, like, who's going to champion this story? What are the set of identities and intersections in your work that presses or journals hold? Because if you go to those places, I think you're going to have a lot more success than, like, throwing spaghetti at the wall and being like, I submitted here. You can do that.
Yeah.
But there's a cost. There's, like, an emotional cost to
yes.
doing that.
Yes. Okay, we're all going to come sit at your feet so we can be instructed. This is great. This is very good first novel, first memoir, first book advice.
Yeah.
Second and third as well. You know, I don't think it changes. This is the part of the podcast where I completely lose my thread, my train of thought. It just choo-chooed right out of the station. Day two brain. Choo-choo. Here it is. It came back. We had Sugi Ganeshanandan on yesterday. I should take a moment to pause and send my apologies out into Instagram Live land because we only got half of her face.
Oh.
Because she was our day one guinea pig, which feels... very unfair because it was a lovely interview.
It was fantastic.
I'm very sad about the half a face thing. If it's any consolation, it was just my nose. So there's that.
That's why you're sitting right here.
Oh,
right now.
I get to be the beneficiary of that. Okay,
yes, exactly.
Thank you.
We are standing on her shoulders today. But to pay her back, to sort of right the wrongs from yesterday, she asked a very good question. And we would like to know if we can have any of our podcast guests give her some helpful advice. She spent the last 15 to 17 years, I don't know, 18 years writing a novel that was recently published,
yeah.
Brotherless Night. And now she needs to know how to start because I asked her the question, what's next for you? And she was like, I'm going to sleep and then I don't know. Somebody help me figure out how to start. So what are you going to do next? And do you have some strategy about the next project?
I think that giving yourself the permission to take the time you need is really important. Because I felt like even during launch, like literally people were like, what are you working on next? And I'm like, I'm launching a book. This is a lot of work. I don't know how to, like, my publicity brain and my creative brain aren't the same brain.
No, yeah.
They are very different. And when one is on, it's really hard to access the other one. So yeah. Her book just came out.
Yeah.
My understanding is it's doing amazing. I had a friend who told me to read it right before I came here. You know, like, I think first it's like, give yourself permission to be like, I'm in publicity brain right now. And that means I am thinking about this book, right? You spend 15 years on a book.
Yeah.
It deserves your care for another year while you, like, get it out into the world and do it justice in all the ways you can.
Yeah.
I sometimes think the publishing turnover pressure is actually really destructive to creativity.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't let you acknowledge that, like, there are conditions you need for creativity, and launching a book is not those conditions.
It's not?
No. In fact, it is not at all. So, like, that, I think, is the first thing.
Yeah, that's
good. I think the second thing, and this is maybe a little different for nonfiction than fiction, I'm not sure, but, like, you know, it took me a lot of time to figure out my questions for my first book.
Right.
It took me my whole life to figure out those questions.
Yeah, right.
So I'm like, I don't think I'm going to figure out the questions that fast. Like, it took 43 years to get this first set for a 42,000 word book. So at this rate, like, I'll get a question a year for the next 43 years. Okay. That's fine.
Yeah,
there's something about just being patient with yourself and knowing, I don't think it'll take 43 years. I already have started working on a second collection. I think I know what the questions are, you know. But
yeah.
But letting yourself have permission to be like, this is going to take the time it takes. And good writing
takes
the time it takes.
It does.
It doesn't operate on it. Okay, so now you published this. So in 3 years, you need to publish again. Like, I don't think that is a recipe for, like, your best work. I think it's a recipe for satisfying the demands of an industry. But if you can say to yourself, like, my best work is more important to me than the demands of an industry, then I think it's really about just giving yourself the time.
How did you get so clear-eyed? How did you get it all figured out? These are life lessons I feel that take a lot longer than 43 years.
Longer than 43? God, it's taken me so long. I
just want to say I think you're doing great.
I have amazing mentors who
That's
are
awesome.
Very clear-eyed.
That's great, yep.
Just like such a good, like, bullshit, sorry, detector, but
you're
like,
allowed,
you know,
to
like
say it, yeah.
I'll text and be like, this is the thing. And they're just like, no, or yes, right. They've been doing this for about 20 years longer than I have. So they have a lot of clarity, that I don't, but I have the common sense to, like, listen to them.
Yeah.
So I think having those mentors who are further down the road, who've kind of done the churn of, they've done the big press life, they've done the small press life, they've done all the things, they really offer a lot of guidance on, like, what to understand and expect from each space.
Yeah, that's great. Finally, to wrap this up, what's the most AWP thing that you've heard at the AWP?
I was hanging out with Sage Rochelle yesterday, who's an amazing essayist, and she said, I didn't plan to buy any books while I was here. As she was, like, buying books, right?
That's quality overheard at AWP right here, folks. That's very good. This has been an absolute pleasure. I'm so glad that we got to meet your work and now meet you in person. And I cannot wait to see what next thing you do. And I'm just glad you're out here in the world doing the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so lovely talking to y'all.
Effing Shakespeare is a production of Bloomsday Literary, hosted by Kate Martin Williams, Jessica Cole, and produced by me, Fu Lu. Our trusty and hardworking intern is Elena Welsh. With special thanks to Juanita Lester and the AWP staff, without whom this would not be possible.